Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. 13 years ago, a brutal, bloody battle erupted in Syria. Barbarity reigned supreme, killing became a spectacle for TV consumption, and the international community was fiercely divided. It seemed like the worst war ever. But today, the Syrian state isn't just standing, it's recovering, rebuilding ties with former adversaries, and looking to the future. Is such a scenario likely for the conflict in Ukraine? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Ramzi Ezzeldin Ramzi, an Egyptian diplomat and a former senior official at the United Nations. Mr. Ramzi, it's great to see you again. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting.
Now, your most recent position within the United Nations was that of Deputy Envoy for Syria for 2014 till 2019. And this conflict is dear to my heart as well. I covered it from the ground. And I remember at the time when it was raging, it seemed like the worst nightmare ever. But there were at least some efforts, public efforts, including by the United Nations, to mediate it. Unlike in Ukraine, where even the sheer mentioning of talks is an abomination, at least for the Western side. Which of these two conflicts you find more challenging as far as peace prospects are concerned?
Well, I mean, if you look at what happened in Syria and trying to draw the comparison, when there was a prospect of progress on Syria, it was because Moscow and Washington were able to agree on something. And they agreed on Resolution 2118, which basically was to get rid of the chemical weapons. And then a few years later, Resolution 2554, again, was a result of an agreement between Russia and the United States. And that is remains the framework for a settlement in Syria. In the Ukraine, it is different. I mean,
but what has changed? Because I remember at the time, it was very challenging. Nobody believed in the peace prospects, but there was, well, at least some hope that those talks between Obama and his Russian counterparts were somewhat genuine. And nowadays, there is no wish of even appearances. What has changed to make a war a far more preferable option?
Well, I mean, as you know, the situation in Syria today in terms of hostilities have been reduced enormously. But of course, there is a de facto, I would say, division inside Syria. So the fact, because there is no ongoing hostilities, or at least intensified hostilities, the international community is not as engaged as it used to be.
Well, it's not engaged at all.
Well
maybe
unfortunately,
behind the closed doors. But
well, yes. I mean, of course, the activity now is less than it was before, because then the war was raging. There was a humanitarian issue. There was a political issue. And the world wanted at least to give the impression that it was trying to do something. Of course, the UN was trying to do something, but the Security Council, as you know, was deadlocked. Today, because, for a number of reasons. One, because, like I said, hostilities are much less. Second, because the Russians and the Americans after Ukraine are not on speaking terms, literally. So given that, there is much less interest. Of course, with Gaza now, all the focus is on Gaza to try to resolve this tragedy. So unfortunately, there isn't much attention being paid to Syria. The one positive development that happened in Syria over the years has been an Arab re-engagement in Syria. And I think that was very important. But unfortunately, after Syria has been, its membership has been restored in the Arab League, there was some momentum, but it seems to have been lost over the past few months. So let's see what happens.
There is an opinion here in Russia among experts that because of the proliferation of proxy wars that made fueling of wars, indirect fueling of wars possible for many actors without necessarily incurring the losses, conflict resolution is no longer, not only no longer possible, it doesn't make any sense because it's not only proxy wars, but sort of proxy settlement of conflicts as well. Do you have any ideas of perhaps any constructive way of putting an end to this franchising of war when both war and peace are essentially by license, they're, you know, given on off to somebody else?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you bring up this point because this allows me to introduce another element which I think is implicit in what you're saying. Wars now are simply not war between countries or civil wars, which means within a country, but there is the non-state actors who have become extremely active and have entered and complicated whatever conflict, whether it's internal or external. And that is an issue that is very, I think, dangerous if allowed to continue. And you can see that in Iraq, you can see that in Syria, you can see that in Palestine, Gaza. So I think this is an issue that the international community has to focus on.
Well, hopefully it does. Now, in one of your articles, you made a very interesting point that despite its extensive military involvement in Ukraine, Russia hasn't fully withdrawn its military assets from Syria. And in fact, it's essentially demonstrating its capability and its resolve to fight or participate in two wars simultaneously. What do you think it means beyond mere appearances?
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, Russia has made an enormous investment in Syria. It's an investment that dates decades, has increased, of course, since 2015. And I think there's every reason, I mean, looking at it from a Russian point of view, not to give up this investment. Clearly, the focus now is on Ukraine, which is understandable. But I don't think Russia, and it has demonstrated that it will not reduce its footprint in Syria. But I mean, let's also not exaggerate things. I mean, in Syria, Russian involvement is not, of course...
It's minimal, but it's still minimal. Effective.
Exactly. It's extremely effective, but it is minimal. And they're able to maintain the same profile mm-hmm. in spite
Can
of
I
Ukraine.
Can I ask you something? Because, I mean, you're a very reputable Arab diplomat. I'm sure you know the position of many Arab countries. And at the time when Russia was sending its fleet to Syria, not many countries welcomed that apart from, let's say, Syria and Iran. Do you think the Arab neighbors of Syria like Russia being there, even in its minimal capacity now, or would they like it to leave?
There were those who wanted regime change and those who were supporting the regime, and there were those who were neutral. I think what has happened over the years, that those who sought regime change came to the conclusion that this is not in the long-term interests, because if the war continues, two things will happen. One, Syria will explode, and that will have security implications for them, and it would allow Iran to become further entrenched. So they've come around finally, I think a bit late, I mean, but it's never too late, but they come to realize that it is their interest to help Syria maintain its territorial integrity, whether it is through Turkish incursions or Iranian, I don't know if you can call it incursions, but interference or interventions in one way or the other, directly or indirectly. So they've come around. They understand now that they need to preserve the territorial integrity in Syria. And if that means working with Damascus, they are. And you can see that Damascus, Syria is back again in the Arab League. Now, on your question about Russian presence, I think those who wanted regime change in 2015 were extremely disturbed by the Russian intervention. But because their position has evolved, I think today they look at Russia as, in fact, an influence that helps in maintaining the territorial integrity of Syria,
so it's
ultimately.
So a stabilizing factor, in
yeah,
a sense.
But also as a counterweight to Iran, which many, in spite of the progress in relations, and I think that is important between the Arab countries and Iran, but of course, Arabs are very concerned about Iranian and Turkish intervention in Syria.
Now, since you mentioned the issue of territorial integrity, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think as things stand right now, Damascus, with assistance of Russia and Iran, controls about two-thirds of the territory.
More or less, yes, I would say so.
With the Americans and the Turks being in charge of the remainder of the territory. And I think it's pretty likely at this point that the Americans are not going to cooperate. But what about Ankara? Do you see any scenario in which Turkey would be sort of looking benevolently not only at Syrian reconciliation, but also Syrian reunification?
Well, I mean, I think Ankara has made it very clear. They are for preserving the territorial integrity of Syria, because for them, any possibility of disintegration in Syria immediately brings in the Kurdish issue. And so they, for them, maintaining the territorial integrity of Syria is, I think, a very important thing. I think, again, like the Arab position has evolved, I think the Turkish position has evolved. Again, it was all about regime change, if you remember, from the very beginning. And then slowly they come to realize that the regime is going nowhere. So they had to be practical, they had to be realistic, and they understood it, to safeguard their borders with Syria, which is more than 900 kilometers long, they need an interlocutor and a strong government in Syria. They may not like the government, but they tried to change it and they couldn't, so they had to deal with the reality. And since then, there has been contacts.
Now, is the reality primarily about the Syrian government, or rather, you know, not a very trustworthy nature of the powers that wanted to replace him, I mean, or it?
Well, I mean, for Syria, I mean, if you look at the Turkish position from initially, it was basically about having a government that was, I would say, friendly to Ankara. This is what they wanted.
But this is what they had at some point of time.
Well, they had, and if you remember when the Syrian crisis started, the Turkish government tried to mediate. But apparently they set conditions that the Syrian government did not accept. And their conditions was basically the makeup of the Syrian government to put in elements that they were comfortable with, which for the Syrian government were completely unacceptable, because if, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood until today is considered a terrorist organization in Syria. So there was no chance that this would happen. So this was the initial Turkish position, and they, for a few years, did want regime change. And then they came to realize that that was not going to happen, and that their primary objective was to secure their border, which means the Kurdish issue, and ultimately to be able to deal with the Turkish issue in whatever form. I mean, I'm not going to get into details how it's going to be resolved inside Syria or inside Turkey. You had to have a government in Damascus who would be responsible for the border.
Yeah, well, so they had to become a little bit more realistic and a little bit more humble, which is what we are going to do right now by taking a short break. But we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Ramzi Ezzeldin Ramzi, an Egyptian diplomat and former senior official at the United Nations. Mr. Ramzi, before the break, we were talking about how the position of many regional actors has changed, perhaps has become more pragmatic, not as grandiose as before. And it's important because ultimately the Ukrainian conflict is also about finding some sort of a compromise. Do you see any potential venues at this point?
I heard, of course, Minister Lavrov today. I've been following the pronouncements by Washington and many European capitals. And I regret to say that I'm not optimistic about movement on Ukraine, certainly not before the American elections, which is most unfortunate. So I think what needs to be done today is to avoid further escalation. I think that is absolutely important. And then create conditions for a possible negotiating process down the road. But that's not going to happen right away. I mean, we've seen, I think, just a few weeks ago, last May, China and Brazil put forward a proposal, which is in that line, in that direction, in the sense of de-escalating. And I think that's the most we can hope for. When I hear all talk about further escalation or talk of use of nuclear weapons, you know, even rhetorically, I'm extremely disturbed.
But the reason why the issue of nuclear weapons is being brought up is because, at least for Russia, this is an existential issue. This is very close to home. And the argument I'm hearing in Moscow all the time is that the Americans, because they have this capacity of waging proxy wars, be it in Syria, in Libya, to some extent even in Gaza, in Ukraine, they do not bear direct losses. And because of that, they lost a sense of fear. And there is no other way of containing them or bringing them to senses. And that may seem like a belligerent rhetoric, but I want to ask you as an international diplomat, is fear important in international relations? Do countries, or otherwise, how would you bring you know, powerful countries to, you know, a sense of responsibility, to a sense of connection with their own policies?
Well, I mean, as you know, deterrence has worked over the years.
Well, that was at the time when the Soviet Union and the United States were directly at the loggerheads.
True. So now you have proxy wars, you have non-state actors. And I think I said earlier, this is an issue that the international community has to deal with in a much more serious manner. When things come to the Ukraine, of course, the situation is, I think, tragic for all involved. I think there were opportunities to reach a settlement, and I think they were dashed for a variety of reasons. And now I think stories are coming out, and I think history will judge why this opportunity was missed. But any miscalculation is going to be further tragedy to what is Ukrainian people and the Russian people on the border are facing. So I think this is something that I think we have to avoid at all costs, frankly.
Now, I don't know if you would agree with that, but at least from the Russian position, at the core of the Ukrainian crisis is the failure to agree on a regional security infrastructure, something that would be all-inclusive, where all countries would feel more or less secure, although perhaps not perfectly so, and that opportunity clearly was missed. But I heard you articulate and call for some sort of pan-Arab security architecture. Do you think that's possible? And do you think Arab countries would be allowed to come up with such a plan? Because clearly any regional security arrangements that do not involve the United States are not always to its liking.
In the Middle East, you have Israel, you have Turkey, you have Iran. And what I've always advocated is to have a comprehensive in the sense it has economic, cultural, political, military dimensions. So it deals with all of these issues. And at the same time, inclusive in the sense that it is not directed against anyone. On the contrary, it includes all these countries that I've met. So it is a very complicated process. It will take, I think, a very long time until it materializes into something concrete, but you can proceed in steps. And so you said Arab system. Yes, you have to start a serious discussion amongst the Arabs as to how they envisage the future of the Middle East, what are the real threats, how they're going to cooperate, and articulate a vision that they will take to the other parties. It's not just Israel, it's Iran, and it's also Turkey. Turkey is somewhat problematic because it is a member of NATO. So I think we will have to find an innovative way
to deal with that. Well, even Russia has managed to deal with that.
Exactly. But I mean, first, I mean, I think Israel is clearly has demonstrated that it poses a genuine threat to all Arab countries after what has happened in Gaza. I think for a number of years, as you know, there was a tendency, and I think this was an exaggeration, but there was a tendency to basically say the Palestinian issue is not important, that Israel can be integrated in the region without resolving the Palestinian problem. I think that is over, and I think that is very clear. But I don't think it's clear to the Israelis. I think the Americans probably understand that, but I'm not sure if they're going to act upon it. So it is really up to the Arab countries to articulate a vision and then take it to the other parties in the region. So it's not easy. It's going to be difficult. And I think if you read my articles, I have put conditions. And one of the conditions is a Palestinian state.
I want to ask you one more question, or perhaps two more questions on Gaza, because for the time being, the negotiations center primarily around the particulars, like the release of hostages, rather than the fundamentals of the conflict. And the argument is that, you know, it's so complicated that there is no point of discussing history. We should start somewhere, preferably with the small things. Do you believe in such an approach? How do you think this issue should be dealt with genuinely?
I think in the past, Arab countries, and I can speak for my country, we're prepared to discuss, principles. We're prepared to discuss past grievances, historical brief. But I think after Gaza and the double standard that has become apparent to everybody, whenever I speak to anyone and who is prepared to seriously discuss resolving the Palestinian-Israeli issue and the wider Arab-Israeli dispute, I say, I'm not going to talk about the past because it's clear where Israel stands. There are two narratives, and they will never meet, at least intellectually. So let's talk about the future. And that's what... Now, if we talk about the future, yes, I think something can be done and should be done. But I'm not prepared to discuss the past because I think Israel's record over the years and has been confirmed in Gaza is very clear. So that is over and done with. Now, how to proceed? Clearly, what needs to be done, and I think that is almost a consensus minus one, which is Israel, even the United States agrees. You have to have an immediate ceasefire. Second, you have to ensure humanitarian aid to all of Gaza. And then you have to prepare the ground for negotiations down the road. I'm not optimistic that the negotiations will take place, particularly with this government in Israel. I think it's out of the question. But you should, the international community should agree, and I think most of it does, but I think more needs to be done, in setting very clear parameters that will govern the future of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which is centered around a Palestinian state. There has been a little progress in the Security Council. I think much more needs to be done. I think one of the things is that there should be bilateral recognition of the Palestinian state. I think there should be, it's not just declaratory, but there should be concrete action to demonstrate to Israel that Palestine is a state and is recognized by the vast majority of the countries.
Now, Mr. Ramzi, you mentioned many shoulds. Who should be the one to enforce or put forth to Israel all those shoulds? And I'm driving this question specifically to the United Nations, which as an organization was created with a clear mandate of trying to avoid or settle conflicts, which it hasn't been doing lately. I think that's pretty obvious. Do you think this organization is still capable of fulfilling what it was created for?
It is capable, depending on the political will of its members.
Well, clearly it's not there, but perhaps the institution itself does not allow for
I'm not sure. I mean, specifically, if you talk about the Palestinian issue, there has been, I mean, it's very slow. It doesn't justify what's happening inside Gaza. But the situation has shifted, including in the Security Council. Not enough, in my view. More needs to be done. But I don't think ultimately, no matter how much, and I think you've alluded to that, that Israel acts with impunity because it has the support, and you didn't say it, but of course, of the United States. Of the United States. Now, I think the United States position has evolved. Not enough. Much more needs to be done. But the only way to bring the United States to where we would like as Arabs and as the international community is to continue to put pressure on the United States to evolve in that direction. I don't think the United States ultimately, no matter what the relationship between Israel and the United States, that Israel is almost a domestic issue in the United States, I don't think the United States ultimately would like to be left alone in the world.
That's an interesting point, because clearly Russia and the United States are not on speaking terms, as you mentioned, but you just said that the rest of the world, the Arab world, needs to put pressure on the United States. Do you
Absolutely.
Think the United States is actually amenable to any kind of pressure? And if so, what kind of pressure may change the American position?
Well, let me put it this way. Going back to 1973, the Arab countries were able to unite in spite of their ideological differences, in spite of their political differences. They were able to unite. And we saw what happened in 1973 and its immediate aftermath. So it is possible. The United States, the whole process, the peace process, so to speak, started, of course, in Geneva with the Americans and the Russians as sponsors of the process in Geneva. That was long before Camp David. Today, the Arab countries are, in my view, in a stronger position than they were in 1973. They carry much more economic weight than they did in 1973. Today, Gaza unites them, and it's very clear that the Palestinian issue is not going to go away, and there is no way Israel will be integrated in the region before this Palestinian issue is resolved. So there are things, and they carry more weight today with the United States than they did in 1973. In 1973, the only thing they did was the oil embargo. Today, they have at their disposal much more weapons, including soft power, that they can exercise. And if you look at the situation inside Europe and in the United States, I mean, it doesn't say there will be a shift today, but you can see that there is almost a distinction between the political elite, whether in government or out, and the young population. And of course, this will take time. But at the end of the day, if you are a democracy, you have to consider that.
That's a big if, but time will tell. So Ramzi, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.